Hello and welcome to Ready for Nintendo. It's April the 14th or the 15th, episode 472, and I am your host, James Jones. With me today, Mr. Guillaume Vayette.
Hello.
Hello, Guillaume. Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Hello, Greg. And possibly the me of John Lindemann, or maybe the real John Lindemann.
This is the real deal, man. There will be no tech that will ever replace this.
Translation, Mitomo already got old.
I'm still playing it, man. Hey, I have my bonus for every single day since launch. Deal with that.
Deal with that. Yeah. How will I sleep at night? But also this week, we are joined by Mr. Lewis Pugh.
Hey.
Second time on the show.
It's good to be back.
Thank you for being here. We're actually going to spend some time talking about his upcoming game, Twisted Fusion, and sort of the game development process in the second half of our show, where we'll also be revealing the poll for our next retroactive. And we've already recorded that segment, so now I'm trying to pretend like it's going to be a surprise. But you'll be surprised, probably. Anyway, it's time.
Please skip ahead.
For a new bit. Yeah, well, if we're going to do this thing asynchronously, you all get to come with us. But now,
upload it in that section now.
No, it's too much. Now it's time for new business. And as the guest, Lewis, what have you been playing?
Oh, I've been playing a variety of different things. The most recent of them is RC Maniac's latest release, which is Super Robo Mouse, which is a slight, I would say, deviation from his usual stuff. I wouldn't say it's a huge one. It's basically the concept is you play as this mouse, you control yourself with the analog stick, and that's it in terms of controls. The buttons don't do anything. And your goal is to collect 5 different cheeses of some sorts. I think that they're like metal cheeses. I can't remember their official name. And then once you've got them, get to the goal. And so it's top view. There are like lots of spikes and moving platform, guarding platforms, and there's enemies which kind of fire out spray bullets at you. And that's kind of the simple gist of it. You have a few different worlds. As you complete all the stages in a world, which you can do in any order, you can tackle a boss, which is a bit different. But the big thing about this game, which I didn't know going in, is that it's actually incredibly hard. So much so that I feel it should have almost been pitched with that in mind. I've only actually completed now the first 3 stages. A week ago it was 2. And so, despite what I would think is like the very kind of cheerful, bubbly nature of the game in terms of, it's a game called Super Robo Mouse. I'd say has more in common with something like Super Meat Boy. It's a very, very difficult game. The good thing about it though is whenever you die, there is no real loading. You just kind of snap back to that starting point. Admittedly, you have to collect those things again, which can get very frustrating, but I guess it's kind of the point. And there's this kind of interesting, at least the way I play it is, it's this frustration curve where I find myself, the more times I die in this game, the quicker I try to get back to my point of failure. In terms of, like, if I die with, like, 3 cheeses at hand, I was like, alright, I need to grab those things as quick as possible so I'm not losing time here. But obviously, in doing so, I just stumble upon quicker ways to die.
Yeah, it's a recipe for failure. Yeah, it's a recipe for going backwards. But it's only natural, believe it. I've fallen prey to it many times.
Yeah.
So is it a problem that would be solved if there were more checkpoints, or...?
Well, that's the tricky thing. I mean, I think that would ultimately change the flow of the game in the sense that, it would help, but the kind of the point of the game is the challenge in the sense. Like, if you remove the challenge, there's nothing there. You're just collecting these objects, getting to the goal. Job done. I feel the better solution potentially would be to have a you know, a more lenient difficulty curve. So those first few stages ease you into it. The game doesn't do that. I guess the advantage being that you can pick which stages to play. I've not really played around with that, to be fair. I've kind of assumed that each stage is going to get more increasingly difficult in a world. Maybe that's not the case. Maybe it's just a random collection and they just happen to be numbered. Because you can pick them in any order. I probably should go back and experiment with that now I've said that out loud. But yeah, I think either way, that first world may make it a little bit easier. Or the alternative, as I suggested at the very beginning, is make the presentation or at least the messaging around the game like, be warned, you're in for a challenge. Or if you like challenges, this is the game for you. Yeah, I was caught off guard, but I'm having fun. But yeah, very, very tricky. Still in that first world. So if this thing keeps ramping up, I'm not entirely sure how far I'm going to get in this thing. But like Arthematics, other stuff, it is a very cheap game to get on the eShop. It does have that going for it. I don't mean that meanly. As in it's, I think it's good value, as in terms of what it is priced at. And yeah, it's nice and sharp. It's silly to mention the technicals of it, but I mean, it runs at 60 frames. It's nice, sharp, sprites as such, although it is a very simple design. And the music's pretty nice. It's kind of a retro-y type thing, but I'm surprised it didn't get too repetitive, having that same tune repeated over, like spending like almost like an hour or so on a particular stage and having like a couple of minute loop repeat. Considering it did a very good job, but yeah, I can't imagine really playing the game in longer bursts than that in the first place. So yeah, I quite like it. It's a pretty cool thing, but yeah, it's my warning at least is if you don't like games with a particularly a big challenge element to them, probably one to avoid. But if it interested you, worth checking out. Nice cheapie. The other thing I wanted to talk about, and I won't spend too long on this one because it's not new at all really.
Never stepped us really.
I guess.
Well,
no.
Well, I mean, this is a particularly special case in this one, but yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so it is somewhat topical, but it's Bravely Default, not Bravely Second. Reason I'm playing it, again, I should say, is because of the sequel. I've not got it yet, although was prompted, oddly, by the launch of the demo, which reminded me of, oh, the demo of the first game was really good. Oh, the first game was really good as well. I never did beat that, did I? And then went back to it and then realised I oddly stopped just before the halfway point in the game. Which, having got a lot further in it now, seems a very strange place to stop. Because as soon as you hit that halfway point, you start, and I think it's pretty common knowledge now, although I won't do any spoilers, you start doing a loop of sorts of the type of places you've been to and the types of things you're doing. You basically are doing the same thing again and again for a bit. Depending on how you look at it, it can be quite tedious. I think it was handled fairly well considering, but that might just be because I've been so forewarned that it was coming. The fact that the characters are aware that they are doing the same thing again and again, and it's not just a player having to do it, I think does help. Where I am now, though, in Bravely Default is all the way to the end. In fact, again, I don't consider it a spoiler. I'm at a chapter called The End. Not going to say what's in it beyond there are bosses. I hope that's not too much. But, oh. Exactly, yeah. I've also, from a JRPG, there's bosses right at the end of it. The good news, though, they aren't repeats. At least not yet. But the big tricky point for me is and talking about difficulty curves, there seems to be a massive one, at least how I've been playing the game. I know there's so many options and how many different ways you can play this game. A lot of people probably don't have the same experience. But after I jumped from chapter 8 to the final chapter and started having to go through these bosses, I was just getting my ass handed to me again and again and again. I kept having to change strategy to try and make my way through, and I eventually did. But I've still not finished the game. There's still bosses to do, which have given me a very difficult time. I feel I'm at a point I'm going to have to go off and do a lot of grinding, which I really don't want to do. But I'm so close to finishing it. And I'm enticed by the Bravely Second. And as silly as it sounds, the Bravely Second demo. I've got that free on my 3DS. I want to jump into it. But I kind of want to get this done and dusted, as it were, before I do. And so I hope I don't have to spend too much silly time grinding around just to defeat like a boss or two to get to the end of the story.
It's an interesting thing. My experience with the end of that game, I certainly found get the final sort of bosses that you get to, which aren't repeats of ones you've done before. It did feel like a sharp uptick in difficulty. But just through real stubbornness, I refused to grind. And I'm certain it didn't make the experience quicker. I probably just ended failing those bosses so many times that it consumed more time than it would have done to grind. But I just kind of felt like it was in reach, you know, with just if I played a little more, you know, soundly, strategically, maybe a little more conservatively, you know, willing to kind of make the battles even longer, which made defeats even more hard to take.
Yeah.
But, you know, eventually I got to a point where, you know, I did, you know, without grinding, without messing around with the, you know, just sticking with the builds, the job loadouts and everything that I had already, I managed to beat the bosses. And even though they are kind of an example of something I don't particularly like, which is just the ridiculous bloat and excess of, you know, JRPG finales. It was actually quite rewarding to get there, you know, to do it just by improving my utilization of the battle system rather than just going off somewhere and grinding the numbers.
Yeah, I guess it's good that there is that option available, yeah, as an alternative. So I guess, well, in theory, one could go off and grind for a considerable amount of time, go back and have a considerably easier go at the bosses. But yeah, there is that element, as you just said, you can just apply, whether it's more skill or just the strategy of butting your head against a wall until it finally breaks down.
That is my go-to strategy with everything, really.
Yeah. That's what I've been doing currently. But the problem is, yeah, it feels like I'm fairly close. But I mean, you're always at the point where until you are able to do it, you're not actually sure it's actually possible. Or at least I always have that in the back of my mind. Am I literally wasting my time?
Especially
when
the enemy
can just overwhelm you.
Especially when there's this kind of thing where it's like, oh yeah, you know, I'm on course to do really well, and then some event happens in the battle, and it's like, oh, guess what? It's got its health bar, it's got unveiled this devastating mega attack that you didn't see before.
This is not my final form.
Indeed, yeah.
So I would say that the two things: one, leveling up in this game. When you level up, you feel it's a nice tangible boost. It's not like one of those really really smooth short gradients where you're like, guess I'm slightly stronger. But pressingly, as I talked about on the show when I was playing this game, this game does have hyper grind mode where, because you can pre-program in a battle routine and put it in auto mode.
Yeah.
And you basically just turn the game in fast forward, turn the difficulty way down and the enemy density way up, and just run around in place. And you're not even looking at the screen. You hear the battle music start, you take your hand off the movement buttons, you hear it end, you go back to running. You just watch TV. You could probably gain levels in like minutes. But I mean, it's shitty to even have to do that, but at least it's there. And
it's a strange thing to praise, really, isn't it? That they've put these systems in, which let you automate it so much, but not completely. Like, if you're doing it, you almost feel, like, why not go the full way? Like, are you sure's and you can add a level or something.
It's just the fact that you've got to that. You kind of have to earn it, though. You know, you kind of earn in, like, the jobs and the abilities and all that kind of stuff. Such that, you know, so it's like, okay, well, you know, I could group cast poison and then cast the spell that kills everything that has been poisoned, and it just wipes out everything. You know, you get to a point where that auto-battling is actually possible without having to think about it much, because normally there'll be different enemy sets in a given area, so what might work against one set wouldn't necessarily work against another set or whatever, so you wouldn't just be able to totally switch your brain off and let it go. So you kind of, if you've got to that point where you can literally do that, you've earned it in some way. But I know what you mean.
Right. I would say if you've lost like two or three times in a row and you feel like, oh, I don't even know if I can do it, just go back and get everybody one or two levels. I mean, it won't take very long. And like I said, the boost between levels is noticeable. So that may be enough to put you over the limit. I will say that the ending of that game is surprisingly good payoff. Like,
Let's get to it.
There's a fairly, well, in the for the sequel, which is the Japanese, like, iterative version of the first game, the one that ultimately we got. There's an extended AR sequence that's pretty cool.
Yeah, because the other thing I'm curious about in this game is that upon loading it, there are four options, I believe. But only two of them are accessible currently. So I assume those two things unlock when you complete it, or unless... or one of them does.
I think one of them is New Game Plus, and the other one is just to watch that ending AR sequence again. Oh, I really think it's that basic. But, yeah, that game sequel comes out for me in 28 minutes. And, like, I'm sitting here going, like, oh, God, am I ready for this?
I think, for me, it was a considerably smoother experience than the first one.
Okay, well, that's good.
And it's got, I mean, it's a very similar experience, but smoother. I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I definitely went by, you know, more enjoyably than I think the first one, but don't expect anything drastically different, you know, because it really plays it really super close to the original.
Fair enough. Well, Greg, you actually have something that's new in two ways and old in another.
It's exclusively new, isn't it? Yeah,
it's going to be new forever.
But yeah, before I get into what I've been playing, I do want to mention a couple of dates to watch as we record this. So, first of all, April 20th is the 10th anniversary of Mother 3's release in Japan. So, if there's any kind of substance to all the fairly significant rumblings there's been about Mother 3 finally getting localized and brought out outside of Japan, it could be a date that where we might hear something, or it could possibly be another kind of pre-E3 type of deal like it was with Earthbound Beginnings last year. But that's one date to look out for. And the other date is a week later on the 27th. That'll be the earnings report from Nintendo to their investors. And that will be interesting because it's obviously going to have to broach the subject of their forecast for the next fiscal year. And that gets us into NX territory. And I certainly wouldn't be expecting any, you know, major kind of details or anything to be doled out in that way. But they are going to have to broach certain general subjects like, you know, if this is in their plan, you know, to be selling a bunch of units of hardware in the in this particular fiscal year, how they're going to meet these projections, whatever. They might have to broach some of these topics, and maybe we'll get some, you know, new kind of information for the first time in a while about that subject. So we'll always have coverage of that kind of thing when it breaks. There's usually something in there, as well as the always enjoyable sort of asinine questions about why they just don't stop making video games or whatever, though we always enjoy those. But there'll be some interesting things in that briefing, I would imagine.
Well, and now, unfortunately, Devilish Brain Training will not show up on the upcoming games list when the European version. Yeah.
They just keep they've been toying with us for so long. I don't even know what it is.
Hold on to hope.
I know. Like,
I believe it finally dropped off on the last.
Yeah,
one, so.
I know. I mean, like, because like WarioWare Twisted, I think was kind of like that at one point, but there was that health and safety thing with that, you know. So I don't know what it is about Devilish Brain Training. I thought we got Devil World. Like, what? I thought it was okay here. I don't understand.
If God damn it, all right.
But to move on to what I've been playing. So yeah, I tested out the Super Nintendo Virtual Console service on new 3DS with Donkey Kong Country 2, Diddy's Conquest. Which just came out today in North America, but it came out a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, in Europe. But yeah, the reason why I kind of went with this is I did play it on the Wii Virtual Console, which terrifyingly was like 9 years ago. It's almost as long as it was, you know, so like, what, 12 years between when it came out on the Super Nintendo and the Wii, and then 9 years since that.
This goes back to a couple of weeks ago where we said double nostalgia.
Yeah, it is a bit, because that's the thing. I mean, I played that. That was the first time I played DKC 2. I had the original on a cartridge for Christmas in 1994. But even though the sequel, certainly the second game, was very well thought of, I never had it because it was just too much of a luxury back when we was paying the import premium to get these games. To have a sequel 1 year later, it just didn't seem like, you know, it was worth it. And we had Yoshi's Island that year instead. You know, it was something I always wanted to play, and so I did on the Wii Virtual Console. But it was a bit problematic because I didn't have my Japanese Wii yet, and so, you know, I was playing it through the PAL service. And even the Rare were very good about, you know, doing things back actually on the Super Nintendo to make the PAL versions more palatable. But still, it isn't perfect because if they, for instance, sped up the game, so you wouldn't have, they corrected the speed, so you wouldn't have the issue of, you know, it goes from just 60 hertz, 50 hertz, and commensurately slower speed. What that introduces essentially is kind of like frame skipping. So it's not going to look as smooth, and, you know, in fact, it might even affect the playability a little bit. I think Killer Instinct for Super Nintendo kind of suffered quite famously because of that.
It would be bad, yeah.
Yeah, with the combos and the combo breaking and all the timing in that game. Yeah,
yes.
It really is. On the one hand, it's like Rare, which, you know, were commended and deserve to be commended for making the effort to actually say, okay, let's try and get this closer to the actual intended experience for PAL users than most, you know, companies were at the time, because obviously they were sensitive to it because they were based in England. But, you know, in some cases it was kind of problematic in itself and certainly not ideal. So I was kind of waiting to maybe one day get to DKC2 again, and I was, Wii U Virtual Console comes along and they start just putting US versions of the game on instead of dragging out the old PAL version. So I'm like, oh, this is great. You know, there's a few of these games that I kind of got before I got the Japanese Wii that I might upgrade. And so we get to the DKC trilogy coming back after their little absence. I guess the rights expired or whatever for a little bit, and then they did a new deal or whatever that was. They released the first one, and that was the US version. They released the US version of the third one, but the PAL version of the second one. So I was like, the one I wanted to rebuy is the PAL version again, so bugger. But the new 3DS VC has come along to save the day, so I can have a sort of unadulterated experience of DKC2 in a form where now, you know, I think I'm going to get more. The first time I played it, I beat K. Rool, kind of saw the standard ending, but it's one of these things where you've got these extra levels that are based on getting all the secret coins. And then ultimately you get another boss and another ending. And I never got into that on Wii VC, and I was thinking, you know, it would have been a good thing for off TV play on Wii U if that had panned out, but it's a pretty good thing for portable. And I've got to say, just in general, you know, the sort of emulation type of stuff, I mean, it's got that original resolution mode, and looking at it on that is on a smaller screen, like my new 3DS is the regular size one, not the XL. It looks really nice. It looks sharp. It looks colourful, you know, it doesn't look washed out like some of the Super Nintendo games do on Wii U. I really like it. This is the happiest I've been looking at that pre-rendered style of graphics since, you know, Christmas Day of 94.
Huh, it's funny because a couple of weeks ago, Retronauts had an episode about kind of like the optimal conditions to play old games meant for CRT televisions, and they basically said that looking at these games on an LCD TV was a sin, basically. And, you know, 3DS, it's definitely not a CRT. So, like, how come everyone praises the true resolution mode of this?
I think the biggest thing, like I said, by being pixel for pixel like this is that, you know, what you don't get is that kind of, and I talked about this in the past, play like NES games on 3DS, where you get this kind of almost like a shimmer kind of effect that happens when you're like, when it's scrolling with some details in the background and stuff. That slight stretching out of proportion that it's doing.
It's kind of like.
Go on.
I was gonna say it's kind of like the pixel or the triangle fighting you see in like a PlayStation era game where like things don't quite seem to be laying where they're supposed to.
It just
it's gross.
Yeah, they certainly do not look very good. I played Cyber's Quest on that, and all. It doesn't seem sharp. But when you go pixel for pixel like this, the difference is pretty clear. And it's an interesting thing, actually, going back to the Retronauts discussion in terms of sort of the authenticity thing, because it is the original resolution. That is, you know, what the Super NES output that it's putting on that screen. And that's why, you know, I said it looks sort of very faithful and sharp and bright, and, you know, it's not getting kind of like washed out or anything like that. However, that original resolution was not the aspect ratio they were making it for. Because in those days, CRT TVs would basically, they worked in lines going down the screen. And so the sort of horizontal aspect of the resolution would then just be stretched or squashed to make a 4:3 aspect ratio. So that's why if you ever see screenshots of Genesis games from emulators, they're really quite wide. And you're like, well, you know, those Genesis games never looked like that. But that's what the native resolution was. But then when a CRTV would spit it out, it would squash them to make the proper proportions. So that's the funny thing is that, you know, in some ways, the original resolution sometimes of a console could give you a look, a sort of proportionality that the developers never intended you to see, because they were expecting your CRTV to be used to output it and that would change the image. So it's like, well, which is the original intent then? It's just the sort of quagmire you can fall into with these old games.
I was going to say, yeah, they have a really peculiar thing. Praising like the new 3DS Super Nintendo emulation, because I've got it myself on my XL, does look very sharp as on the XL as well. But it's not the default option, is it?
It's not, no, because the default option is 4:3, which is actually stretching it out a bit to be a 4:3 aspect ratio as it would have appeared on TVs at the time.
Yeah, I guess that's the reasoning behind it. I never thought of that. But it just seems strange that, for one, that was the default. And two, like, if you were going to stretch it out from what I at least consider the native resolution, why not just go full hog? If you're going to stretch it, just have it full screen. But I would prefer you to default to that one-to-one anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did just wanted to add in as well that it still looks really sharp on an XL screen.
Yeah, I mean, I could imagine it would based on my regular XL, but obviously I haven't been able to make it. You know, I do have an XL that isn't a new 3DS. The joys of the family of systems never, never gets old. But yeah, I mean, so it looks really, it does look really good. And the thing with Super NES games is that they were that different from 4:3. They were just a little more square than 4:3 in their native resolution. So just that difference isn't a huge deal. It definitely is better to go with the native resolution. And like I said, this is the best I've felt about that graphic style for quite a while. It's still aesthetically, you know, there's things about the DKC games I'm not that fond of, the character designs and this, that and the other. But at least now it's got this sort of crispness to it. Rather, I think just the whole sort of process of digitizing, for the lack of a better word, because they were already digital, those ACM models kind of gives it a sort of smeared look. And then if you actually smear it by having it on an LCD TV and this upscaling, or, you know, out of proportion from its original resolution, that compounds the effect and it just is a bit of a mess. But I was really glad the way it turned out on the new 3DS. And I mean, in terms of the game itself, playing again, any thoughts I had about it? You know, I mean, I enjoyed it when I played it back in 07. I enjoyed it again. Like I said, I think I'll probably get more into the secret stuff this time. But I guess the most thing that's kind of clear to me about it is that, you know, this was kind of Rare starting to get further and further away from platforming sort of fundamentals in their games. And it's kind of a cycle that you would see start to take hold in 3D ones on N64. You know, I mean, in this, you get more emphasis on stuff like literally playing as the animal buddy thing. Like, so rather than it being a buddy, you just become the animal. And that's
right,
the level.
That's like you parrot.
Yeah, you know, so rather than, you know, it being like, you know, Rambi being like Yoshi, where, you know, you can lose him and he's gone and then you just keep going. It's like, well, no, you are the, you know, if you die, you die as the animal dies. You know, and sort of all these levels that are very specific, in nature, you know, and indeed the entire last world is all about verticality, which is kind of a nice sort of nod to the overworld, which is you going up Cabral's tower. It kind of makes it feel embedded, you know, in a sense of place. But, you know, you do get this kind of one note sensation to it of just, they're quite different ways of going up a level to progress in, you know, involving animal buddies and all sorts of different things, air drafts and stuff. But it feels like, do these really need to be all together? You know, is that the best way to distribute this kind of experience? Which, funnily enough, makes me think of the retro games, you know, the DKC Returns and Tropical Freeze, which kind of did some similar things, like let's have all the water levels together, or let's have all the minecart and barrel jet levels together virtually. You know, it's funny, I didn't recognize that at the time, that was almost like a something that was in the spirit of the original DKC games. Maybe it was to some extent, but you know, you get sort of these. You go forward to the 3D era, and Banjo, while obviously it was quite different from Super Mario 64, especially with the whole emphasis on learning abilities, whereas Mario 64, you pretty much had everything apart from the caps from the get-go, and you just went forth. You know, once you got... That was still something of a 3D platformer, I feel like. Once you get to DK64 and Banjo-Tooie, it's so full of mini games and so full of, like, almost quest lines, I would say. You know, like, you've got to do this to unlock the Mumbo pad, and then Mumbo does this, and you can then do that, and then you could split up and do something else. Like, it gets so convoluted and so not really about platforming. It's like another kind of game altogether at that point. And I kind of feel like, obviously, this is, you know, a side-scroller, so it's not in the same way, but you just feel the amount of levels that are spent here with animals or minecarts or this, that, there isn't that much core platforming on offer. And I think it's mostly still, you know, enjoyable kind of experience. I think that's the one area I'd say the new DKC games trumpet, is that the core platforming experience is more front and center and just more challenging, arguably, and just more and more important, more essential to the experience. So that's why I like them better.
Fair enough. John.
Well, all right. Now that we've talked about that classic platformer, let's talk about another classic platformer. So
right out of the gate.
So yeah, so at RFN we tend to get review codes, not really review codes, but just codes for games every once in a while. And we were sent a code for Epic Dumpster Bear by Log Games. Now, Epic Dumpster Bear, by its own admission, the tagline for this is, an evil corporation destroyed his forest, forcing him to eat dumpster food to survive. Now it's his turn to take out the trash. So that's the epic part of it.
So is this Cobra?
I think so. So, yeah, so this is a...
Is this the sequel to... what's this called? Disaster?
It may be. I'm looking for...
Nobody can live up to Ray.
It's just the really terrible Americanized remake of Pompoco you never wanted.
Yeah, I'm hoping Steve Hewitt is an Easter egg in this, but, you know, we'll see. But, yeah, so Epic Dumpster Bear. It's a 2.5D platformer, I will say this. This game is not great. By any means, this game is not great. But it's not terrible.
I'm glad you'll say that, John.
It's not terrible. It's not terrible. Yeah. So, the platforming is actually not bad. For some reason, okay, so you're a bear, right? And your goal is to make it to the end of each stage. There's various obstacles. You're climbing on platforms that look like, for the most part, giant shipping containers, and you can kind of slide along on. You can kind of almost like rail slide along ropes and stuff like that. And the enemies, you can hop on them to kill them. You just like jump on them and bop them on the head, but they're like cows.
Bear's number one enemy, cows.
Yeah. Cows, actually, I mean, we're talking cattle cows, because these enemies are fairly realistic looking.
As opposed to what kind of cows? Oh, you mean like pictures of cows?
No, I mean, but not even like cartoony cows. Like,
are you fighting clip art cows?
No, I'm talking about realistic cows. I mean, it's just the cows. Let me just say, the cows were more realistic than I anticipated. You know,
more realistic than the bear. Though.
the
were you
bear
not
looks pretty.
Prepared the cow's realism.
The bear is pretty realistic. More realistic than I anticipated. This whole thing is more realistic than I anticipated. So,
I see, like kind of in the already made assets kind of way, or
yeah, kind of.
But like, were they in on it, or was it just like, I don't know, let's do this cheap?
I don't know. I think it was kind of a more, let's just do this kind of on the cheap kind of thing. But so,
oh, okay.
All right. So your goal is to make it to the end of each stage, obviously, right? At the end of each stage is a
sure.
literally a bullseye on the ground, which your bear jumps up in the air, and I think you get scored based on how close you are to the center of the bullseye. And your bear literally does a flop onto the ground and lands face first on the ground and lays there for a while, and then eventually gets up. And the crowd cheers for him. And the closer
it
you get to the
like
bullseye.
It sounds like my evenings when I come home.
It's probably very similar. And
the crowd cheers when I get up, yes.
Yep. And I mean, the levels consist of course, you know, you have to avoid the enemies, you have to avoid the cattle. There's also birds that drop bird crap on you, and there are like these kind of mechanical flying robots that shoot at you. So in terms of actual platforming mechanics, you can run, although I don't really know why. There was really never any reason for me to actually have to run faster than I was ever going to avoid anything. You do sometimes to make certain platforms and stuff like that. But probably the most enjoyable thing is you can do kind of the wall jumps, the sort of, God forbid I compare it to like Super Metroid, but you can do kind of like the wall jumps or any of the Metroid games where you do the wall jumps where, and you have to do that. You can collect coins, and you have like 3 red coins that you can get, very familiar kind of platforming stuff where, you can collect normal gold coins, and then there's special red coins. The gold coins, they unlock special stages where, you know, they have like, there's puzzle elements to them. So there's something different. You can kind of switch them up.
So you're saying this is epic 3D bear? Is what you're telling me now?
Yeah, it's 2.5D bear. It's all side scrolling. Okay. It's a side scrolling platformer. So yeah, it's not bad. I mean, it's not, you know, and you can move around on sort of a Super Meat Boy-ish game board where, you know, you don't necessarily have to follow a prescribed path. You kind of open up bonus paths and stuff like that. And there are bosses, even though I haven't played it in the first world far enough to actually get to a boss. But apparently I think there's about 70 levels, so you can go quite a ways. But yeah, I mean, if you're looking for something weird, not necessarily great, but you're looking to scratch that platformer itch, you might want to try Epic Dumpster Bear.
If you're looking to scratch that burning itch,
yeah,
is it a conversation piece, John?
I would say it's a conversation piece.
Or more just a piece.
Again, you know, it's a weird game because it's not... Like, when you first start playing, you're like, oh, this is going to be awful. But the platforming is actually competent. I would not go as far to say that this is a well-made, well-crafted game made by professionals. I would not go that far, but it's not, I don't know, there's something about it, man. I don't know.
Crafted game made by semi-pros.
Yeah, I would say that.
There we go. So, John, let me ask, is it more or less weird than Cutie Friends Pick Berries?
It's probably less weird.
Okay.
It's a pretty straight-ahead platformer, aside from the fact that just the characters and what they decided to use is just kind of random. I mean, even the fact that it's a bear, it's...
Well, hold on.
It doesn't really...
It's an epic bear.
I don't know if it's an epic bear.
Or is it a dumpster bear?
It's more dumpster bear than epic bear. I'll tell you that. yeah. So, I mean, and there's not much of a story. I mean, it could have been anything. It could have been epic closet octopus, and it probably would have been the same thing. you know what I mean?
It's like, it's just, you know. It's,
oh, I know
you just...
about closet
octopus. Yeah, it's an Octodad kind of a closet octopus guy in that, you know.
Yeah, I guess.
That's
yeah.
true. You know,
I'll leave that up to the audience to decide, but. You know, it's one of those games where they kind of said, "Yeah, let's make a platform game, and let's just pick the most random elements and throw them in there."
I just wonder if the bear element actually came later in development, because everything you've described, it seems quite a straight platformer, and it feels like it could yep. have been a last minute decision. I feel this game needs a bit of an edge. It needs some sort of character beyond this generic.
It needs a bit of an edge.
Let's trace over some photographs of bears and call it a day.
Yeah, yeah. Let's replace all the existing assets with animals and make the main hero Epic Dumpster Bear.
I mean, Epic Dumpster Bear is a great title. I'll say that.
It is my band name.
It certainly intrigued me, you know, because, you know, I have to admire the moxie of this game to call itself Epic right out of the gate. I mean, Epic Dumpster and Bear are not three words that I would expect to find in a game title.
I'm fairly confident, unlike our email last week, nobody has named their stop motion animation Epic Dumpster Bear. But if you have, I will represent you.
Probably not.
If someone comes out with Closet Octopus, of course, as well.
Yeah. Well, that might be more predictable. Guillaume.
Yes. So I've been going back again. Like, the last few times I did this, it turned out to be a bad idea. I went back to a game that I gave up on really early. Thomas Was Alone. I must have gotten it on PSN for free, and then I went, nope. But then, for whatever reason, must have been on sale on the Wii U, and I got it still because I was... I don't know. So I played this, and turns out that I was actually it might have been a good idea to give it a second shot. The first time, the reason I gave up on it, and I guess it might be just a very particular pet peeve of mine. Like, I perhaps not everyone has this hang up, but the narration. You play in this game, you play as a series of like squares or pixels or whatever it is, rectangles, and they've got different forms and rectangles or squares. So yeah, different forms, but also different sizes and different abilities. Like, some have double jumps, some can't really jump very much, but are maybe like flat and will fit in certain openings that others can't, etc. Like, it's kind of like puzzle platforming mechanics, but very, very basic.
With squares.
So you've got this narrator giving personality, I guess, to these squares. And but he goes, at least initially, like, it sounded very much to me like a Little Big Planet fable-ish, you know, Stephen Fry talking condescendingly to adults playing a children's game kind of thing. And I'm just not a big fan of that. Like, I don't think Thomas Was Alone is a huge hit with kids. It might be, I guess. I think it sold well, but I think this game is aimed for adults, so I'm not a big fan of the whole, like, you know, like, kind of story time British guy telling you, yeah.
you would have hated
Jack
and
Rory. Those British guys, God, they get on my nerves.
I would have hated what?
Jack and Ulri is a kids' TV show in Britain, exclusively with British people reading to kids. So,
oh boy,
that's
read your own damn books, kids.
Maybe I would have liked it, you know, as a kid, but today, yeah, I don't know. So yeah,
what about the narration in Elibits? Where are you on that?
Oh God, yeah, no, that's. I think we've talked about
this. That's
not
a narration. That's a person getting therapy.
What about when Johnny...
English is his third language, Greg.
What about when Johnny does the Elibits theater?
Yeah, well, you know, grown women doing kids' voices are probably a close second, and like that, you know, voice acting that just turns me off. But
So what you're saying is, if future Little Big Planet game had a condescending intro from like Helen Mirren pretending to be a child, you would set it on fire instantly.
Anyway.
So now that we've created Guillaume's least favorite game.
That's one aspect of the narration that I didn't enjoy. The other aspect is that it just seemed poorly done, because in the initial levels, they're very simple, like they start you off very slowly, there's nothing that can kill you, there's... I think the very first level, you don't even have to jump, you just have to fall. So, you know, they start things off very slowly, but they've got this narrator kind of, you know, giving a voice to Thomas. Like, so Thomas thought, like, it seems like I'm conscious of my own existence. How weird. But the problem is that the level is so simple and so short that the narration actually, you know, you'd have to sit on your hands and not do anything while the narrator finishes before actually taking the exit that's right there, you know? So I thought, like, you could have, you know, maybe tested this a little bit, maybe made the hall a little bit longer so that even at full speed, I would not run out of level before the narrator is finished. But anyway, so, like, those two problems kind of made me think, like, this game is really kind of, you know, annoying and poorly made. Anyway, so I gave up. But eventually... So this week I came back to it. I'm not a huge fan of the platforming itself. It feels like, you know, and the fact that the levels are too short for the narrator kind of point to this. It just feels like in general, most of the levels could have used more testing. There's this weird, you can't really say a difficulty curve. It's more like a difficulty sin wave. Where you've got some, you know, you've got some levels that are just so brain dead easy that, you know, like I might as well have just listened to the audio. And you've got other stages where weirdly frustrating, there's like one hit kill. So yeah, so the difficulty is very uneven. So I'm not too much of a fan of that, but I gotta say that eventually the narrator did win me over, and I found myself kind of caring when suddenly, like, something tragic and unexpected befell one of the characters. And it's kind of funny, you know, because the characters are literally just squares on the screen, and I went into it. Eventually, I was just like, okay, so apparently, you know, Jung just got eaten up by this thing, and I'm upset. Because John was kind of cool, you know? The tall rectangle that could really jump is now dead and is now gone, and it affects me. So,
no, you're crying over spilled rectangles, Guillaume.
Yeah, so I gotta say, I have to, you know, break this old rule. I have to say that the game is charming, and I would say that is the reason why... That is the reason to play it. Like, I don't think it's an especially strong platformer or puzzle platformer. But if you give it a chance, eventually, like, the story kind of ropes you in. And it's interesting. I mean, it kind of shows you just how little you need to be immersed in a video game. You know, like, some people say, well, you know, I need I need VR, or I need, like, graphics so realistic that I can make out, like, the texture of this brick on the wall, you know? But here you've just got a bunch of squares jumping around and some British guy telling you about them, and that's enough to kind of really get pulled in. So, yeah, I don't really, you know, like, there's not really that much to say about it. I would perhaps wait for another sale before getting it, because it's quite short, and
it's an experience more than a game, it sounds
yeah,
like.
It's an experience, yeah, more than a satisfying kind of game that you'll go back to again and again. And as charming as the story ended up being, it's also not quite, I'm not sure if it really holds up completely. Like, they go with this thing, like, I guess you're playing as AI in the simulation, and each chapter has 10 level, but each chapter starts with, like, an on-screen text that's supposed to be kind of, like, testimony, after the fact, you know, like, a quote by a researcher so-and-so, like, oh, we didn't know, by the time we realized what was happening, it was too late to stop it, you know, and, they kind of keep things perhaps a little bit too vague, while kind of making it obvious that Thomas is kind of this AI that's kind of trying to free itself from the program, the game gets really gets kind of cute about the fact that this, you know, you're playing as this AI that's trying to get into the internet, I guess, and but it doesn't really, while it's well done, it's not really, it doesn't necessarily lead to a coherent story. I don't want to say more because, you know, people should see it for themselves. But yeah, no, it was a nice little game, and you know, once I got past the condescending British narrator, I was fine.
Do you think it would have been improved if they just used the narration that was cut out of Blade Runner eventually instead?
Oh.
So you're just looking at a bunch of squares and Harrison Ford saying really deliberately badly, skin job is like saying the N-word for robots or whatever. Would that have made the experience better?
I would.
Thomas didn't know how long he would have, but then again, who does?
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, that wouldn't be really out of place in this game. But
Oh, good. Good. Anyway, I'm actually going to forego new business this week. I'm still trudging through Project Crosszone 2. I'm very deliberate in how I'm pacing myself in it, and that's helping quite a bit. But what am I doing with my life? What I am doing with my life is I'm throwing this to a break. Because after the break, we're going to talk to Lewis about his upcoming game and on making games in general. Stay tuned. It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up in this horrendously unfunny and annoying segment, you have a review revisit, Earthbound on the 3DS eShop. Brian, Donald, and Matt take a look at the classic game that has gone from being rare to everywhere in a very short time. See how this 1995 RPG holds up nowadays as they re-rate it for your trolling pleasure.
Yeah, RPGs are pretty rare these days, James, so...
Yeah, I've only got a backlog now of three. Let's... I'm glad that the 3DS is finally getting the JRPGs it so desperately needed. We also have a preview, Star Fox Guard on Wii U by Don Koopman. Don puts down Tested with Robots long enough to have a run at Star Fox Guard, a tower defense game that is getting released because, well, Nintendo has nothing else. Yes, this is the Wii U in 2016, but hey, the game isn't bad. Find out what Don was pleasantly surprised by in his preview.
And we have a review of Bravely Second End Layer on 3DS by Brian Rose. Thankfully, our RPG drought has come to an end, thankfully, with Bravely Second End Layer. Brian compares it to the first game and finds that it's actually a bit better overall, in his opinion. Read his review to find out what additions he considered to be improvements. And we have a review, another review, of Oddworld New and Tasty for Wii U by Don Koopman, a remake of Oddworld Abe's Odyssey. New and Tasty brings the classic platformer to the Wii U, and Don gives us his review. It ain't perfect, but it remakes the original game in style, and you should read Don's thoughts to see if it's up your alley.
Oh no, I can't do that one.
Yeah.
I was going to go, you can go up our alley. We're not...
You can walk up our alley, maybe?
You can climb up our alley. You can find what's new and tasty on Nintendo World Report right now at NintendoWorldReport.com. I'm going to double say it. You can't stop me. I edit this thing. And we're back. We're not doing listener mail this week, but if you want to, you can send us your email anyway. We'll use it. It's RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. There's a little asterisk there. We may not use your email. You know who you are. But instead, we wanted to talk to Lewis, who, you know, we've had on the show before. But, Lewis, you're making a game.
That's right. I'm making a Wii U game.
Yes.
Of all things.
So, yeah, I know we've had you talk about, you spoke about the game before on the show, but I'd like to, just a refresher.
Yeah, certainly.
Give us the elevator pitch version of your game.
Oh, that's funny. That I'm going to pretend we're in a very tall building, if that's okay.
That's fine. Because I mean, like
very,
let's
very
not,
nice
not...
tables, very nice chairs, everything
exactly.
High end.
Okay.
Are you still in Donald Trump mode, John?
That's how I roll, man. Classy.
Running to the boss. Okay, the elevator pitch Twist Fusion. So yeah, Wii U exclusive. It is a yet another one of those 2D retro type games. Although it is it's not necessarily what you'd expect when I say retro game, because the sprites are kind of native resolution. Anyway, it's open world platformer. You can play it with up to 4 friends locally. It's kind of Zelda-y, as in you can tackle dungeons or towers, as they're called in this, in any order you want, through purchase of special abilities for a shop, which you can access at any time. In addition to all that groovy stuff, there's this big side component, all to do with monster questing, and you can also find monster eggs, raise your own monsters, battle them, fuse them, that sort of Tamagotchi, Pokemon, Digimon type thing. And that stuff can be going down on the gamepad as you go through this 2D open action platformer, either solo or with your friends.
Go ahead.
It's a bit of a weird game, to be completely honest. You can play it pretty straight. You can just play it as a, you know, just a one screen 2D game, player step, as a story game from start to finish. Or you can just mess around with like side quests and such, with friends, with multiple screens, one screen. Lots of variations to this thing. Lots of customization.
I asked you to give the elevator pitch because I knew that there was like things in this game that were going to have to be explained, and I was trying to put you on the spot a little bit. But
that's cool.
I'm trying to be the interviewer here, and I'm not great at this one. So don't tell anybody. So I think last time we spoke to you, was that during the Kickstarter?
I believe so, or very shortly afterwards, potentially. But definitely around that sort of time, yeah. A lot of these kind of components I just mentioned weren't necessarily even a thing. Which may have explained why the game has been delayed somewhat as well. It has changed.
I wasn't going to mention anything.
No, it probably should be. It's changed in scope. Purely out of, I mean, I'm just finding... Oh, wouldn't it be good if sort of scenarios, when I'm playing it through, it's like, it'd be nice if there was some sort of game loop here. And yeah, things keep getting added and then that have to be balanced and then I think of other things and then I go, oh yeah.
Yeah.
If I could better use the gamepad or why not have 5 players instead of 4 players? Why not?
So what are you learning in this process?
I'm learning that I probably should have some sort of project manager who's not me when I'm making a next game.
When you see the report out of the Nikkei about Wii U production ending at the end of this year, does that increase your sense of urgency for getting this done?
It does increase it. Probably not as much as it should be. But yeah, I'm kind of almost jokingly like, I really do hope I get this game out while the Wii U is still a thing. That would be ideal, because it is a Wii U game. And I don't know why me as an indie developer with no contractual obligations have decided to make this thing a Wii U exclusive. But I've gone full out. It pretty much ticks all the boxes of things the Wii U can do. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely a Wii U exclusive game. I mean, you could technically port it to another system, but it's going to lose a bunch of its features, like the real-time multitasking and all that groovy stuff. So development-wise, it's actually very, very, very almost there. I've been running a few public betas for the last month, and I hope the game's going to finish development this month. There'll be another one or two public betas during this time. And then it will go through the Nintendo process. So I'm not entirely sure when it would actually land at this point, because I haven't told Nintendo a set deadline, because, well, I had before and I had again, and it slipped past those. So I'm not sure when it would land, but I'm hoping to finish development of it this month.
So how does that process work? Do they have they been giving you feedback throughout the process, or is it just kind of a, hey, here's a build. All right, cool. See you in a couple months kind of thing?
It's at least from my perspective, I can only talk from that. It's been very hands-off, to be completely honest. I initially told them what I'm doing. Not had a terrible amount of back and forth contact since that point. So I've just been off doing my thing, making this game. I'm hoping Nintendo's going to like the thing. But you know, one of the things which has changed during this process is how it's going to actually be released, in the sense that I will actually be able to do a same week, if not same day, like European and American launch, which on the original planned launch date wouldn't have been possible, really, with the different rating bodies involved.
So that's interesting, because that's something that Renegade Kid have talked about, isn't it? Because they used to have big delays between the regions, and now they've been able to get closer. Can you illuminate how the nuts and bolts of how that has changed?
Keeping it fairly vague, I think the reason why the reason why you can do it like simultaneous releases, never possible before, is that the American rating boards, the ESRB, you could do it fully digitally. You could send them the screenshots, the information dumps, and so on. Whereas the European bodies, you couldn't. They needed physical copies. And obviously there's, some physical time there of posting it and people testing it and sending it things back and so on. And I believe now that's changed to digital as well, or there is at least an option for it to be. And so you can line those things up very quickly. Get your feedback up, get your PDFs and your stamps and so on, and upload them. I think that's the big thing, the fact that the European one have digital options now opposed to going through the old physical route.
Right.
Well, and to that point, relatively recently, I seem to recall the talk of the various rating boards sort of, allowing you to kind of use each other, or they were going to use each other in some way. I'm trying to remember what the exact...
Yeah, that's the other big thing which kind of goes alongside the European one going digital, is that previously there were different bodies. There's PEGI in the UK. I think it's USK in Germany. And there's a few others. But yeah, now there is a single system which you can upload, and it does that work for you, essentially, and you get those different ratings out of it. So you can deal with one entity opposed to multiple.
I like that we're here to talk about video games, and by 8 minutes we've made it to ratings boards and these particular bureaucracies. It's not endemic to Germany. So, Arfen, giving you what you asked for.
In the past, it was a real kind of barrier with certain publishers, I guess, maybe just because of the way they did things, their process. Like Nicolas, in particular, really used to struggle to get anything out in Europe in any kind of timely fashion.
I think
it's nice to
know that sentence after struggle to get anything out.
Well, like I said, you would know the difference if you'd lived here, believe me.
So let me take a step back. So what, when you said, you said they've been fairly hands-off. So what resources, understanding, what you can say, what you can't say, that kind of stuff. What resources do they make available to you on that front? If you got problems, is there places you can go for help? Is it just really well documented? Figure it out on your own?
So yeah, when I say they got hands-off approach, it may just be because I don't feel I've necessarily needed further assistance. I have all the tools that I've needed to carry on my little development journey. Lots of good documentation. There are technical forums which other people under the appropriate NDAs can talk to each other and to help each other out. There's obviously software downloads. There's obviously physical stuff involved, but obviously, that stuff gets handled on, earlier on in the journey. Lots of good resources. I have dealt with Nintendo on that side of things as well, opposed to, picking up the phone. And I have spoken to other Nintendo developers, mostly indies, through that platform, and they've helped me out, and I hope I've helped other people out as well.
And so yeah, there's a good community there. And so yeah, you can get lots of information and help with your project without even necessarily going direct to, in quotes, Nintendo, as it were.
Hmm. They just sort of act as a facilitator by hosting the communication.
Yeah, and they're definitely involved, and they're moderating, and they help out as well. But you can obviously, you know, just talk to other people who are, you know, obviously able to sign in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So there's a high self serve component, and I'm sure they try to push it that way.
Oh, definitely. You know, obviously, that works out beneficial for them, because if they can supply tools which are good and like services which people can use to help each other. That gives them time, obviously, to do other things, whether they're building new tools or, you know, just other things in Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, how did you get into the decision to make a game?
To make this game?
I understand. Well, actually, let's take a step back even further. You kind of do the same thing that we do. Or I don't know how active you are at this point in the middle of making a game, but you know you
That's
have
a good question.
I know you wrote for
It was in Fendo.
Yes, and you did podcasting.
I believe the last time I did the show with you guys, I was both host and editor.
Oh God.
And
oh my God!
Developer.
Why?
Yeah, so that changed.
That sounds exhausting. Yeah,
it was.
So why? Why? Just why? That's the only question I have left anymore. Why? What were you thinking?
I don't know. I mean, as soon as development started, obviously that had to change. But now I'm not with Infendo at all. I mean, however, the scene has continued. I'll keep this bit short, but I'm now doing a podcast called Nintendo Voice, which I realise is very similarly named to another podcast. I was going by domain names when I chose that name. That name was available across all the services. I was like, oh, that's great. Why has no one thought of that? Ah, someone did. Anyway, it's called Nintendo Voice. We're doing it for about a year now. And the reason why we did the old switcheroo was it's the same cast of characters on the show, but it's our show now. Previously, the owner of Infendo basically had no like contact with us, and we tried to reach out on occasion. Oh, you know, isn't it time that we updated this site and so on or whatever? Heard nothing back, so we decided we might as well at this point just start on our own and reap any benefits which may come out of it. And more importantly, just it's our own identity opposed to this mysterious boss man taking credit for our work when he's not contributing anything. So yeah,
it's kind of the opposite of our situation where Neil's just like, what the fuck are you guys doing?
Yeah.
When are you gonna do Now Playing? When are you gonna make it not a train wreck?
To be fair,
when
Neil
are you gonna
advertise
a site instead of troll it? You know,
Neil
like
never
that.
Asks when are you going to do Now Playing, it's when are you going to stop doing Now Playing.
Yeah.
Just doing both last week was exhausting. I can't imagine doing that and trying to make a game. So,
how long is this? How long is this journey? This story, this development journey of yours, been taking?
It's an interesting journey. It kind of officially started beginning of 2014. Mm-hmm. At which point, I think technically the year before, I became officially signed off as a Wii developer. And then I started working on the game, and then in April 2014, I did the Kickstarter. And at that point, I was apparently fairly confident in promising it would be finished and released on December of the same year.
You're one of those Kickstarters.
I was one of those.
I'm sure you were so young and naive then, right?
So, have you made the gentleman's bet with the Mighty Number 9 people at this point?
I
can get it out first.
Well, it's a promised deadline, so.
Yeah. How many could you break?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, yeah. I've made two, release date things, as it were. The initial one, which I said, I reckon I'll finish it by the end of the year. That sounds, I put my, you know, fit finger in the air. That sounds like a good amount of time. That's a long amount of time, right? Didn't work out. And then I said, okay, the game's actually almost there. Ironically, you know, considering we're quite away from there now. I was like, okay, there's not actually a huge amount to do. I mean, you can almost get through the entire game at this point. Okay, I'll give it an extra 3 months. That's a good amount of time. And to make up for it, and this is the kicker, to make up for it, I'll say, oh, don't worry that you're going to have to wait an extra 3 months. You're going to you know, play with 5 players now instead of 4, because I think that won't take too long to add in. And something else as well. So I was adding the extra work for myself, and obviously that didn't pan through. The main problem I realised there is, although technically, yes, I mean, even at that point, the game was in somewhat of a complete state in the sense that you could play through the game. You can get, you know, you could start the game up and you can get to where the credits were meant to be by the end of it. At that point, it didn't have any of this kind of side stuff. Because it was an open platformer, it just felt very empty. It felt like something was missing because you had this big world, but there wasn't really anything happening in it. And so you were just like navigating this world, running from place to place to find like the next tower, or, you know, your next challenge. And it was just felt like something was very missing. And so I started, you know, adding these things in, and then development grew and grew. And the other thing which mixes all this up was, and this is all very peculiar now I'm recollecting it, as it were, but on the year of 2014, so the initial year where I did the Kickstarter, I said it was going to be finished by the end of the year. At some point during that, I started talking with Arsene Maniac. I started speaking to him before the Kickstarter, but I started to speak to him again, and we decided to do a crossover project, which is actually released. I think it came out that year, or it might have been early in 2015, which is Block Drop Cross Twisted Fusion. And that involved me taking the Block Drop sample code. I changed the engine up a bit, because before it was like, you drop blocks, you got to try and get this particular block on the ground safely without falling off or hitting spikes or something. And I added an element where there are now enemies, and the block you're rescuing is now a thing, and you got to get the thing down without it hitting an enemy, but it also has to land safely. And you have to squash the enemies with the blocks. So I added that extra element, made 50 levels. Originally, again, that's something I thought, well, if I'm taking someone else's code, retweaking a puzzle game, that won't take that long, right? it wouldn't take super long, but I originally thought the whole thing would take less than a month. And I think in the end, it took about 2 months, which doesn't sound that bad, you know, coming from it. Because it's a pretty nice game.
Well, I guess, I mean, how has this, has all of this gone with your Kickstarter backers?
To be fair, they've been pretty good in this journey. There's only been a handful of times when people are like, hey, where's the game?
Yeah.
Maybe it's a combination.
Have you told them that it's a journey? Welcome to my journey your money. Welcome.
Well, I think what's helped. I think what's alleviated the situation is during the development, I've always done these betas, which people. And this is an interesting thing, because it is a Wii U exclusive, and you can't really do a beta. Well, I guess actually there is a beta now, isn't there? Lost Reavers.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of weird hoops to jump through if you want to do a proper beta on a system like that, because it still needs to go through lot check and all that. So it still needs to be at a stage where it meets all those standards, which my game wouldn't be at that point. So the beta for Twisted Fusion, people can play on their PCs in a browser, and it simulates a Wii U, and it's by my design. You can have the two screens going, and you can flip them, or you can just have one screen. It's no proprietary code. Now I made that. and so people have been able to play the game, or what the game was at that stage.
Yep. And that's important because, you know, like, the, you know, they've, that's to maintain trust with your Kickstarter backers,
right? It exists.
Yeah.
Because I think the main thing with Kickstarters which get delayed is it just loses trust in, not this, I think mostly, yeah, in terms of like, not that it has been delayed, but does this mean like it's troubling and like will the game actually come out now? Because
are we hearing the whole story kind of thing?
Yeah.
Right.
But I think I've been quite transparent in the sense that you could just jump in if you want to, if you've got the time, jump in, play the game, see what it actually looking like at this moment.
Mm-hmm. So, not to harp on, I could do this, probably not so bad.
Yeah.
How long did that take to make a PC beta engine for your game?
That bit was just kind of being made side by side with the game itself, so.
Oh, okay. So that wasn't like a, all right, well, I'm going to go do this. It won't be so bad.
No, it wasn't one of those. That was one of my ideas that I did come up in advance, really. Yeah, I always had that PC beta in mind because there was originally some like exclusive tiers where you would have beta access. And then after a while, I opened it up to all the betas. Basically, after the point where the game should have been out, anyone who backed the game had access to the beta, because I thought, that's fair enough. I mean, they were hoping to be playing this game at this point. At least they can kind of play it already, as it is now.
Fair enough. So, going back to, I know we're jumping around a little bit, but the open platformer concept. Can you kind of give us like an explanation of what that phrase means to you? I mean, I think conceptually it makes sense, but kind of in some more detail.
Yeah, certainly. It does sound peculiar, but I don't want to brand it a particular thing because I don't feel it is. Like, I don't feel it is Metroidvania.
So it's the Dark Souls of platformers, then?
Oh, come on. Not everything has to be the Dark Souls of everything.
So, the way I describe it, it's possibly closest to, and you potentially argue this is like Metroid, but like Mario meets Zelda. I think there is a distinction, though, in terms of it's more of a platformer like Mario, but unlike Mario, where you are, you go to stages, you go from left to right, you complete the challenge, you are in more of an overworld, like a Zelda game, I guess like a Metroid game as well, but it's not structured in a way where, like, the Metroidvania, people think of that, they think of a very particular type of, not just gameplay style, but like game flow. Like, oh, I'm going to go through this area, get this ability, or open up these new areas. Because you can, and it's a bit like Link Between Worlds, from the store, which you can access at any time, you can buy any of the abilities of the game at any point, including, like, soon as you start. And so you can get an ability and go into, in quotes, the last area of the game and start tackling that stuff first. It controls kind of like more like a Mega Man game. It's very action-y. It's a shooter in that sense. And if you're smart about what you get in the shop, you'll shortly have a jetpack, which increases your movability, momentum, whatever, incredibly. And then you can fly around and jet around and that sort of stuff. And that kind of changes up the gameplay. But in addition to that stuff, there is little side quests and such. You can find NPCs, talk to them, they can give you quests, they can hang on a little bar at the bottom of your screen. So I'm not sure if that helps describe what I think when I say open platformer.
Sure.
I hope so. It's the peculiar one, because when people play the game, something I've been doing more recently is just asking them, what game is this most resemble to you? And are you just getting different answers from everybody? So there's no common game which comes up. It doesn't help me describe it, at least yet.
No, I'm interested. One thing that kind of interests me, I've spoken about it a bunch of times on the show for people that have kind of kept track of this stuff, is kind of the idea of like levels, kind of more self-contained kind of levels nested in general kind of overworld kind of thing. Yeah. You do get this a little bit, it's sort of like Simon's Quest for NES, the second Castlevania game, where the mansions are embedded in this open Transylvania kind of setting. And so what you're describing with the Link Between Worlds kind of analogy seems kind of similar there. To that kind of idea. And I guess the tension that I always see with those kinds of games is, on the one hand, when you get into these focused, self-contained areas, you want kind of a very specific level design that appeals to certain abilities, you know, that tests people's skills. And then in the overworld, you want a character that's a joy to control. You know, that can cover distances quickly, that's yes. just fun to use and screw around with. And of course, how you balance those two things, it can be quite tricky. And I was just sort of wondering, you know, I guess with the sort of link between worlds idea, is that how you balance it? That, well, you know, each level is based on the idea of taking one specific ability into it. So that's designed around one of them, whereas the overworld, you could use all of them.
Is fairly similar to that. A lot of, I say, I did compare it to Zelda, but, you know, their towers in this game, of course, are dungeons, and it is not so much, they're not so item-specific. A lot of the abilities you get are, like, movement-type stuff, so your main ones, you got the jetpack, you got your almost Metroid-like, you know, super speed boots. You've got a charge shot, again, that's kind of like a Metroid, isn't it? And you've got a special ability for each character. But again, that's per character, so it's not really... you can't ensure everyone has it.
Sure.
Essentially. Like, there are quite a lot of them. So the puzzles, in quotes, of these towers in the games, again, not so much item-specific. There are definitely some which require skills. Like, there are definitely towers where, you know, you need the jetpack to, you know, get anywhere in it. And for those types of towers, it's clear, like, you enter it, and then you just find yourself in this giant column where, if you don't have that jetpack, you'll not be able to get anywhere. And so that's like a clear point where, like, okay, there's something I'm missing here. I'll poke around in the shop, maybe I'll just come back later. And so, yeah, it does take a lot of inspiration, again, yeah, from A Link Between Worlds for some of those bits. But might not be as reliant on it as you may think, but it was a cool kind of mechanic to introduce into there.
See, when I think open platformer a little bit, and a little bit from what you're describing, I kind of actually think a little bit more like Zelda 2 stuff, where yeah. it's still kind of adventure-y, but it's 2D in the isometric, in the side view kind of way, which is different than what you sort of think. Like, when you think of a 2D adventure game, you must always invariably think of above, because yeah. the idea is more driven around exploring, whereas it's exploring just vertically can seem kind of... It's more easy to represent space, I guess, from above than it is vertically, because people can kind of wrap their brain around it of like, oh, I can go left and right, in and out, and kind of explore an area, versus I'm exploring up and down while I go left and right. I guess because a platformer almost invariably impels you in one direction. But in this open platformer concept, obviously that's not the case.
Chucks you in the middle of the world. I think it's a good place to start. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, and there are other games that have come out that kind of do something similar, although different gameplay styles. Like Terraria is a 2D game yeah. that's ultimately side to side. But yeah, it is much more about kind of exploring a world versus just reaching the end of a stage.
Toki Tori 2 as well kind of had an interesting yeah. spin on that, because you know, you didn't really have abilities per se. You know, it was, you had everything you kind of needed straight off the bat, but you kind of learned techniques as it went on, which would lead you down sort of certain paths.
Right.
So let me ask then a little bit about, as you've sort of iterated on this game, and as you said, you know, adding gameplay loops. What's the process where you've got an idea and you're trying to figure out how it applies? Can you kind of walk us through an example of one that you know, something that you added that started out as kind of like an idea that's how you built it into the game?
Yeah, sure. I think a good one of that is going to be the whole monster stuff, because it's a thing you look at and go, oh, that's a weird addition. It's not necessarily what I'd have expected from this. And that came from... I was playing through the game, doing some playtesting through the towers, as it were, and I was realising it's cool and all, but I'm defeating all these enemies, or I could just jump over and run away from it. I mean, what's my incentive from actually, you know, actually taking these things down? Like, I got these such good options now to move around the world. I can zip around, I can jetpack and such. There's only certain enemies which are going to put up a real fight to that. unless you want this game to turn into some sort of weird, you know, weird bullet shooter type thing. And so I was thinking of one of these enhancements I can make to make that more enticing, make it more engaging. And so one of those things was, you know, it's a simple thing. You put that coin drop in, you get your money, you put that in the store, you can buy things in any order. That's a nice loop. And then I thought, all right, at a certain point, you're just going to buy everything. That's going to be no fun. All right, there's going to be these certain things you can upgrade. And, you know, they increase in price. Now, you know, realistically, no one will level up all of their abilities. And then I thought, that's good, but it still feels like a missing psych. And that's the idea of they can drop eggs and materials, which you can feed them. And then it was also something I had in my head for a little while because I was thinking of things to stick on that second screen. Which, Senna, I'm not sure I've actually said during this podcast, at least, but it basically acts as her in-game smartphone because she comes from the real world and the story is she's transported to this world and she's trying to get her way out. But for some other reason, her smartphone has perfect signal and she has all these weird apps now. It's not explained, so I hope you don't mind. And one of these things is this monster app and you go into it and you got like a 5x5 grid so you can have 25 slots. You can see the eggs you've collected. If you feed it materials you pick up from other enemies, they hatch. And if you feed them again, then they get energy. You can pair up three monsters that you have into a little battle team. Then you can send them off to battle towers. And you can do this stuff as you're like exploring and such in the game, like with the D-pad and the buttons. You can be poking around if you're good at multitasking. And so you can send them off to these battles and... It's almost like a little phone app at that point. So you could see them. It's all automated. You could see their progress in their tower as you're playing around. They level up. It's another interesting loop here. They level up as you fight enemies in the game. And the other thing is, depending on what you've got the difficulty set to, and this is a thing I've actually cribbed fairly directly from Kid Icarus Uprising, is the difficulty slider. I really love that. And so it's got one of those in there. That's one of the apps. Depending where you have that difficulty slider, you get more coins and, again, more experience for your monsters. And so that's an incentive for that risk-reward as well. And then when they're big enough, you can fuse them with your other monsters and turn them into different monsters, and you can send them off to battle. And the things you get from those battle towers do benefit unlocks and such in the game as well, so there's a big loop there. That's a example of playing through the game, thinking, all right, I've designed this tower, testing the puzzles. Combat's all right, but you can easily avoid it, or what's the incentive to keep going, and then putting these loops in. And then I find that people are spending more time in towers, or even returning to old towers, to, you know, do some, you know, in quotes, grinding. Not because they have to beat the game. You don't have to do any of this monster stuff to make, you know, complete the in quote story. But it's something which seems to hold on to people, which is quite cool.
So that kind of makes me think back to other games where stuff like this is introduced and go, oh, that's why that's there. So, and I'll give you an example of what's immediately jumping out to me, because there is a much fairly direct parallel as you're describing this, is, oh god, that's why Chows are in Sonic Adventure 2. It's to keep you to actually play that game for more than 30 minutes.
Yeah, again, it gives you an incentive to actually interact with those enemies as opposed to just running by them as Sonic.
Yeah.
Because you get little crystals out of them.
Or to ever play the adventure stages again. We have to explore. Oh. So now I'm going to sit here and play games and just go like, why is this here?
Yeah.
What are they covering?
I can't say the Chow Garden wasn't any inspiration here. It's fairly direct.
That's fair.
You know, the inspiration from that would have obviously directly come from games like Pokemon and, you know, the original Digimon as the Tamagotchi thing.
Right.
So sometimes it can be difficult when you've got these kind of things to feed it in a way that makes... Obviously, the whole point is that it's kind of different and something that can actually kind of run alongside the game. But I think of the guys, I forget what they call that, but they used to be in Tiburon and they did Hatsworth. which had the puzzle, the panel de pomme thing going on alongside the kind of Mega Man X type of game. And then they did Monster Tail, where you had the monster on the bottom screen. Yep. And all that. So, yeah, it was very inspired by two-screen hardware, you know, with the DS back then. But obviously you got that with Wii U. But then, I didn't play Monster Tail. Johnny did. He spoke about it on the show. You know, Hatsworth, you had these links in there with the puzzle game in terms of, you know, maybe I forget exactly how it works now because I've not replayed that game in quite a while, but it didn't feel all that relevant. You know, it never quite got to that point where obviously, look, they're two very different game styles. I'm not expecting them to like blend into one or anything, but it never got to a point where it felt like they meshed in a satisfying way. It felt kind of an interesting idea. But that didn't quite get all the way there. So it seems like it's quite a tricky thing to nail this sort of. I feel like there is potential there that, you know, not that many people sort of ran with after the DS kind of era.
Dream Rift.
Dream Rift, yes. that's their current name, yeah. They did that Mickey game as well, didn't they? The 2D Mickey game for 3DS.
Powers of Illusion, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's been some talk about a sort of remake of... Monster Tail come into 3DS at some point, but it still isn't materializing, and it feels like the clock's ticking. But yeah, I've heard that at some point.
Greg, you bring up a brilliant point that with like two screen stuff and gameplay, like I guess it's kind of asymmetric gameplay kind of syncing up with each other. I think there's an element of it just gels with some people and it doesn't with others.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine that's, you know, but some people have probably never hit home, I would imagine, just how much it kind of feels relevant, you know, like pertinent rather than just something that's there as, you know, a way to use the hardware that you're working on.
Yeah, and I think there's an element where it's just of whether it's of interest to them or not, and it can be easily dismissed if it's like, well, this is a bit weird, I don't want, you know, this in my game, and then it's hard to win them over. And so, yeah, most of the stuff in the game, like I'm mentioning all this stuff, most of it is optional in the sense that you can, like, choose and pick the bits you want and just run with that stuff. There's very little stuff in it which is like, oh, if you want to be enjoying this game, you need to be doing this thing. Yeah, it's a game with lots of options in the sense I don't want to be funneling anyone down a very particular path just because, you know, it may not be a path that people like. It might be something which resonates with a lot of people, but it's... I prefer my games when I can go in, oh, there's an option there. Or a little slider. I can change this. I think this will be best for me. And I think give people those options. And, yeah, they can tweak the game to their preference.
So, we spoke a bit about, you know, how you've got the ability to let people play it with the beta, and you've talked about how you've kind of put these ideas in to sort of drive, you know, I've got this, I don't want to use the word deficiency, but opportunity here to enhance, you know, a component of the game that I feel like maybe could use something. How have you been able to sort of, use the feedback you've been getting to sort of take ideas that maybe you've put in there and make them work organically? Has that been something that you've been successful at doing? Do you feel like the feedback you get is coming, not just from a good place, but coming from people who are really able to articulate what's working and maybe what isn't?
Yeah, very good question. So feedback varies greatly. So you'll get some feedback which just says, oh, this is fun. which is nice, but it's not very helpful. And you do obviously get some very particular criticisms which may not, match up with what other people are saying. So, okay, do I take this guy up on his suggestion, as it were, and make this change when, you know, I'm not really being asked by other people. And obviously it's much easier when you just get a lot of people saying, oh, this thing feels a bit weird. And so I think a lot of the changes which has gone through is just kind of how the game feels in terms of, the movement, you know, as in the platforming stuff. That's gone through a lot of changes due to feedback. And I think it's a lot better for it. In terms of like this sort of top level functionality, there's not really been a huge amount of change in it from what people have been saying feedback wise. It's been more of the nuances, and a lot of it, and this is not so much about design changes, but it's purely about the technical on the bug fixes. Obviously, it helps out with having beta testers, because the first thing they're going to respond to is technical bugs, which is what I'd love to hear about that stuff while it's in development. And so they can go, oh, in this area, and especially with a game like I've made here with tons of these weird options, things can run at the same time, different, like, oh, I was in this area with this character, with this app running, with these abilities that I bought, doing this particular thing, and this weird thing happened. It's really great to have as many people as possible playing it to catch that sort of stuff.
Well, a lot of people now have had a taste of what it's like to at least, you know, design levels with Super Mario Maker. And, you know, like, you go through your own creation, and you're like, well, yeah, that makes sense. It's obvious. It's easy. Maybe I should make it harder. And then other people actually play your game and your level. And, you know, it was not as obvious as I thought, or you know. Like, maybe this jump is a little bit harder than I thought. Is that kind of, like, are there segments like that that you go through, or have you always kind of kept in mind, like, trying to tone down your difficulty level, or have there been huge surprises for you, like, things that people got hung up on that you didn't expect, or...
So, difficulty, I've realized, kind of really comes in, like, two parts, two different sides. One is, like, combat. There's combat difficulty, and that's completely separate to the platforming difficulty. And especially because, okay, there is that difficulty slider, but that only helps with enemies. Anything related to navigating a spiky corridor with a jetpack, that slider unfortunately isn't going to help you. It doesn't do anything really clever with changing the amount of spikes or the geometry of that level. It's just like hit damage and so on, that sort of stuff.
It doesn't pave over the spikes like Mega Man 10.
No. I did consider having something along those lines at one point. Like, oh, if you're running at a 1 or 2 on the difficulty, it could remove a bunch of the spikes. And then I've just realized it. Not only was it too much trouble, but it was just too hard to just balance and test it. And I decided to have that stuff just be the same no matter what the difficulty was and just have that for enemy stuff. But yeah, I mean, there are... Towards the end of the game, it does get much more tricky. Like, it introduces these moving platforms. There's a lot more of this, again, navigating around, like, these spiky areas and such, like these instant kill type things. There are things in the game which...
I'm imagining the end of Cave Story right about now.
Well, especially the jetpack and the gun, and yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's, with the moving platforms, there's these big circular... saw things, and you've got to jump off the platform, navigate through them, jump back onto the moving platform as it takes you somewhere else, jump back off, continue that. So that was the stuff which is trickiest, to find a nice medium between it being really, really too hard, but it needs to be a challenge, or just it's underwhelming, because you go for it, and then like you're at this final boss, or past it, and you need some sort of significant impact, but again, people have lots of different play styles and skills and so on, so that was the trickiest bits to balance, the actual things around the platforming difficulty. Something I don't think I've really talked about at all about the game is, like, so on the multiplayer side, so yeah, 5-player local play. That means there are multiple characters, which originally it was going to be a thing anyway, but that expanded quite a bit. And so there are, including a few, like costume alternatives to Korra, there are basically about 10 different characters you can play in this game. And they each have their own unique move as well. And so there is, it does pay to, change up your character. Again, you can just play with the default character for the entire game if you want to. There are no puzzles which require you switch characters or anything like that. Mostly because that would be weird for the multiplayer. There's a bunch of these different characters which I've not really talked about before. It is a game where you can switch them up. Say you are a particular person and you talk to an NPC, it does take into account who you are when it brings up that portrait. Or if you unlock one of these, like, bonus costume things, that is reflected in the profile art as well. There's nothing which isn't reflected in that sense. It's like, because that would annoy me in some games. Like, your sprite would change for whatever reason. You got some armor or whatever, and you go, and your profile art is brought up on the screen, but it looks nothing like your character anymore.
Well, that's the challenge. If you commit to doing unique sprites, like, you either have to do it something where it's like one item that doesn't show up in a lot of the art, like a weapon, or you got to go all in. Yeah. And that's such a big jump of a commitment too. Like, it goes from like, well, maybe I have to draw one piece dynamic to, oh god, everything's different.
Yeah. Or you find that nice medium, which is like the Fire Emblem for the 3DS, where they have that kind of customized profile.
Yes. You've got pieces.
Drawn by the different pieces, but you wouldn't necessarily think of it if you just looked at it at a glance.
Yeah. Really good. Yeah, it does. It works out nicely. It's like Mii's, but not Nightmare Edition.
Yeah.
So, kind of getting towards the end of our time here, but I wanted to ask a little bit about, you know, is this the first major game project you've started? Understanding that you already released a game.
It's, yeah, well, it really depends how you judge it. Yeah, I would say it's my first major one in that sense.
So what's your history making games? I guess is a better way of asking this question.
Yeah, sure. History was that I've been making games almost as long as I've been playing them, in some sense. So a lot of visual editors, of course. Things like, I'm going to throw out some random names, which may go over most people's heads, but a lot of Click Teams projects, which were things like originally Click and Play, then the Games Factory, the Multimedia Fusion. So they're all things which you could, all mouse-driven, drag-and-drop, event type programming in quotes, you get your game running. But I remember having that at very early age, like alongside like my first console, I was having that and going that making games on the PC. The first in quotes proper games I would say I was making was when Apple decided an app store would be a good thing to have on their phone. And I agreed. I was like, okay, that's a good way to get things to the people. And so I jumped aboard on that, but even before it was officially released, signed up as a developer, started making stuff. And so I made a whole bunch of iOS games, for iPhone and iPad, and then started making Android and Windows Phone stuff. And then, that's when Nintendo caught my eye, I guess. That would have been in, I guess, 2013, I think that was. I can't remember which event it was now. Potentially GDC?
There was a GDC where they showed off the web framework.
Yeah, that does definitely rings a bell. It was the web framework. And I remember it was a simple thing. Like, they put a page up on one of their public sites, which was like, hey, if you think you can be a developer and you meet some of these criteria, chuck us your email. It was something like that. It was like a little web form. You just filled it out. And a little while later, I heard back, and Zip started going through the official pipeline. Yeah, and it wasn't long after that I signed off as a Wii U developer, and I did the Kickstarter, and then got a physical dev kit.
I'm trying to think of what. Click Team, I have little knowledge of. I'm trying to think of what would be a good example of something like that now for somebody who maybe after playing Mario Maker kind of wants to go a little deeper, but maybe doesn't want to go deep into programming just yet. Because that could be its own type of nightmare.
Definitely. Well, their current version of their product is called Click Team Fusion 2.5, I believe. As that is the product title, not just a version number. And actually, what I have, again, I've escaped to mention, is what I'm currently using is actually, it is a visual editor yet again. Even though I was doing proper, native stuff on iOS, I was just writing Objective-C. And what I'm doing now is a visual editor called Construct 2, which is another good place to start. Although I still use Multimedia Fusion from time to time. Construct 2 is pretty cool. The reason I jumped from that to this is that, this supports the Wii U. they worked with Nintendo to get this plugin set up. And so, yeah, you can use this visual editor and you can pump out code to a Wii U. And, yeah, you can take advantage of a bunch of the Wii U features, too.
That's pretty cool. Because, like, I remember, I kind of had a similar progress, but I did it with, like, RPG Maker as a kid, which is just the home of awful ideas created by children who don't understand anything about writing and just, yeah. But there is something undeniably cool about, you know, making your own game experience. And really, you can go back to, like, Mario Maker does a really good job gamifying that. But you can slide back to, like, DIY, or WarioWare DIY, which is more or less is a click editor, because you create items, you script
them. I think that was very well done.
Yeah.
DIY.
Especially for the tiny screen. Yeah, it's a shame that you can't play that game anymore effectively, everything is gone. Like, it actually is a really good way to kind of learn the basics of that stuff.
Yeah, I kind of imagine alternative reality where they made a sequel to that as a launch title for the Wii U, and it kind of took the place of Mario Maker further down the road. And so, like, Wii U was known also as a nice tool to make your own games on and share them with people on the community and take advantage of that big touchscreen.
That would have been cool. Because it had way more space to work with.
Yeah, had a much better network to share things on as well.
Yeah, that doesn't go away one day. Well, not so quickly one day. I really do encourage, though, if you've gone through the Mario Maker iterations and you kind of find that cycle to be enjoyable, like, really, don't think it's too high a barrier to get in there and make up something really simple. And, you know, I don't have experience with any of the modern tools that you've described here, but I might go grab some of them after we're done tonight and just play with them a little bit.
So yeah, as I said, Construct 2 is the one I'm using to make the Wii U game, but you can just download the normal version of that. There is a free version, so you can just start playing around. And if you become, you know, particularly proficient in it, I mean, there is that potential road that, you know, you could make a proper game out of it. Or you could transfer your skills from one thing to another, because you can do a lot of that as well. I've jumped from a lot of platforms. Again, even from these visual editors to, you know, writing proper code back and forth, there's a lot of these skills you can transfer back and forth, which you can learn.
There's a mental process to problem solving that is endemic in programming, whether you're writing the code or not.
Yeah. And saying that, I mean, even though this is a visual editor and it's something you don't usually have to worry about, it's probably one of the more interesting things to bring up is I've learned a lot about both memory management and something I wasn't that knowledgeable of before, like my management of how my actual code was written, in terms of it needs to go through this entire code sheet and all the related and attached code sheets 60 times a second. And when you start, you know, messing around with multiple screens, and I start doing silly things like going, wouldn't it be funny if the second screen pretends to be a mobile OS and has its own apps so you can switch back and forth on the fly? When it needs to, you know, have all that stuff ready and waiting at a whim behind the scenes, that stuff gets very more interesting, I should say. I've had a lot of fun. And that, to be fair, that's probably been one of the biggest cause of delays in this, is getting it running proficiently along as I develop it, because I wrongly assumed I did a very quick tech version of it before I launched the Kickstarter, going, all right, here's a big world, put a bunch of enemies in it, but a bunch of geometry, play the game, 60 frames a second, excellent. But that was with the omission of all these extra things I would later chuck in addition to just those basic stuff, even though it was a big world and lots of objects. The actual amount of code was, it was probably only running 50 lines of code, where now we're at 10,000 odd. exactly.
Yeah, that'll do it.
That's the big difference.
That'll do it. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to making your own game. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be that hard, but you can make it as hard as you want.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, on that, we're going to have to go. Lewis, when I know the danger of asking this question.
Oh, no, it's the third time.
When do you think people might get to play Twisted Fusion on their Wii U's?
I was going to give you a cop-out answer straight away.
Will it be
an NX launch title?
You added the preface was on your Wii U. The first thing I would say is that beta I mentioned is now an open beta. If you're interested, kickstarter.com, search Twisted Fusion, you can play it right now. In terms of playing the proper game on your Wii U, I do plan to submit it to Nintendo this month. Then I'd imagine, again, putting finger in the air, rough estimate here, probably about 3 months to it actually appears on people's consoles.
I'll see you in 2017, then. Excellent.
Yeah, it's being delayed for the NX. It's just going to add an extra 3 years. It'll be fine.
Now we're going to get in trouble. All right. Lewis, I want to thank you for being here and giving us insight into the creative process and you know, just talking to us about your game.
It's been a pleasure. And this is still my favorite podcast, despite hosting my own and having one before that as well.
Now it's just awkward. Thanks. I appreciate the praise.
It's still mine, despite being on it. So.
God damn it, John.
See, now we know why he's so quiet all the time. He's just very selfish.
Yeah, John is just
I'm doing this for me, man.
We are, John. We just haven't told you yet.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to do it for this segment. But before we go, we have a little bit of house cleaning to do. So, first off, we asked, you delivered. It is time for us to name the games that will be in our poll for the Castlevania Retroactive. They are in no particular order. That's technically not true. It's the order that Greg gave them to me after we whittled down the list. Aria of Sorrow, Super Castlevania 4, Castlevania Rebirth, Order of Ecclesia, and Rondo of Blood. There will be a poll available in the article for this episode. You may vote there. We'll leave voting open for, I don't know, till the start of next month. That's plenty of time. That gives us a couple episodes to talk about it. So, May 1st, I will be closing the voting at, we'll say, midnight Eastern time. Going out of May, into May 1st. Yes, that there. Yes, that's the voting poll. I'm deciding this on the fly. Deal with it. But that is going to do it for the show this week. Again, I want to thank Lewis for being here. I want to thank Guillaume, Greg, and John for being here every week. Because it's John's favorite podcast, apparently.
It is. It's neck and neck with like some stuff on NPR, but don't worry about it.
Are you saying we're not beating out Freakonomics in your head right now?
We're close. Close.
That's going to do it for the show this week. Our ending theme is the Animal Crossing Sweet Day Gate from Nintendo Land.
In honor of the 15th anniversary of the series, yeah, the first game
only
released in Japan on the N64 was 15 years ago, back in 2001.
I think I would have known if I had read one sentence higher in the email. And on that, bye everybody.
Hi.
Bye-bye.
Later.
Kind of surprised we don't hear "What am I doing with my life?" like at least once per episode.
I think it goes without saying, really, isn't it? So yeah, it comes up enough.
I mean, it's not an unusual phrase to be uttered on this show.
I hope my tone during Epic Dumpster Bear kind of communicated that, but.
I wanted to explicitly make it clear I have made a mistake, and yet I'm not stopping myself.